Sorry, it took so long.
Well, we can all say we're so glad he didn't have to cancel this.
Yes, I'm here, so I only had to come down, and I do all my classes here. So thank you.
Anybody like to start? I have tons of questions I could start, but I'm sure there are many questions out there. Someone else would like to raise a question to begin, or a point of discussion.
Yeah, Eric.
Thanks, Jim, as always. appreciate your candor and openness and all this. One of the things, I think that I'm not making this up, but I could have sworn that a day or two ago, I read in the Chronicle about a Title IX challenge in Boston College, in which it was mentioned that there were 33 rapes reported on this campus last year. Does anybody else read this?
It's in the Heights.
In the Heights, okay.
I think.
Yeah, and that was an increase of some over the year before, and it was, is that right? Did anybody else see it? Okay, so, and they mentioned a couple of universities around Boston as well. Those numbers weren't unusual. I guess I probably had an idea that that might be possible, but it's horrifying, right? It's absolutely horrifying. And one of the problems that we've been seeing over the past few years in university life has been the failure of universities to understand how to handle sexual violence, both because they mishandle it in so many ways on every side of the angle. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that context.
So I have a chapter on gender. And I actually, this will be contrary to what Eric just said, but the greatest sign of hope that I see about ethics on a campus comes from two very different places. One is from development. Why? Because they're the only people who are hired here who've had any training in professional ethics. And they have been burnt by lots of gifts by donors who had strings attached that they never ethically worked out what authority they had in holding those things. So development has paid attention to ethics, and you can be at a meeting, and it will be often enough a development person who turns around and says the question, but is it ethical? Because they've been familiar with it. The second is it's almost 53 years old, Take Back the Night. The entire Take Back the Night movement is started by women all over these years. We still do it. And so when Obama had the famous white paper about how the university is really one of the most dangerous places in America for a woman to be, and that she's most at risk for sexual assault at a university, when that white paper comes out, it did not come out of no background or research having been going on for all these years. And when these newest students have filed suits against their universities about these sexual assaults and about the inadequacy of their police or their overall personnel being able to address these issues, that did not happen overnight. This was 50 years of women fighting about this issue. This has been an issue for a long time, but there's an enormous skill set for bringing ethics into the university, and the first place that a foray has been made has been, I think, the White House paper on sexual violence at American institutions of higher education. So on the one hand, the bad news is how many rapes there are. The good news is we're finally acknowledging that they're happening and that they have to be addressed. And these are issues of litigation, these are issues of rights, these are issues that will force policy change. These were happening all the time. All the time. The whole issue of what I'm trying to do is say the university has shown no historical interest in this topic. I mentioned that earlier, one person I really like is Ruth Simmons. Ruth Simmons is a fabulous person to watch because here she goes. She's first African-American woman president of an Ivy. And when they asked, what was it like to meet with for the first time with the other Ivy presidents, she said, uncomfortable. I thought that was the best time I ever saw the word uncomfortable be right with such meaning. But she said, the one thing that she said, you cannot imagine what it was like for me to suddenly hear that there was this group of faculty, students, and alumni who wanted to raise the question about, was Brown connected to slavery? And did they actually end up getting a lot of the benefits of slavery to actually help with their own endowment? She said, if anything was coming to me, that was the last thing I ever wanted, to be the first African-American woman president of an Ivy, and at the same time to have to address slavery at the Ivies. But she ended up addressing it, and she ended up, you know, really chartering a committee to go through it for a 3-year period, where she ended up actually delivering the goods on this. And then Wilder does that book called Ebony and Ivy, in which he talks about all the whole legend, the whole beginning of the narrative about slavery and the university. This is just one of the many. It could be about sports and slavery, sex attacks. These all are happening at these places where 45,000 people come onto these beautiful campuses not knowing what's really been going on and what the history has been. So right now, we see these works coming out, but whether it's about sexual assault or slavery or other issues, it's just now finally coming out. Joe.
A couple of things. One of your conferences, Joe Flanagan. Every year I used to come to Fred Lawrence would have his annual conference, and so Joe would teach on these things, and he made the observation. He thought for years it was important what he was doing in the classroom and how to be the best and so forth, and finally he came to the conclusion the real education of students at Boston College was in the dorms.
Yep.
And that's one point. The other thing, I've been an adjunct professor, and a big problem is credentialism. In a way, I taught at Nassau Community College, Delphi Southern, you know, years ago, and then worked for the government a lot of years, but wanted to get back into it. But you can't break into this. It's a closed system. You're articulating what how a closed system operates.
Right, and a very closed system, yeah, in which the members within it don't know what's happening.
Yeah, yeah, that's part of it.
But this is a teaching institution. I mean, the one institution that should know what's happening are people who do investigations, who are paid to do research. But we do not do investigations of the place in which we teach. Yeah?
Kind of on that note, I know that BC specifically puts a lot of emphasis on faculty research. Do you think that's like a benefit to university prestige, or is more hindering like that visibility between students and other areas?
So in order to do this, I did a lot of research on it. When the question of research, when it was being brought in, was so that we would become better teachers. It was, and Julie, I can't think of her last name, she's in the book quite a bit.
Rubin.
Julie Rubin did this book. How did student affairs emerge so quickly, and what was happening with that? But one of the things is that the universities thought that if their professors could become even better in their research, that they would attract better students and they would have a better skill set in communicating this to them, so that the enterprise of the university would be all the more for the student. However, as they began to reward or provide incentives for this, they ended up taking the student more and more away from the faculty member by creating more and more opportunities for the faculty member to do research. And of course, you could have a URF, you know, but that's one student as opposed to 30. And these changes developed. So she's looking at what was the intention of the design and what is the execution. I think that's a big question. When I took over the Jesuit Institute a year and a half ago, and the first thing I did is I set up a committee of professors of the practice. I had inherited one committee that was to help tenure-track faculty meet one another and do interdisciplinary work with one another. So I had a seminar over at the Jesuit Institute for faculty who were tenure-tracked. So they're in their first 6 years of studies, of teaching here, and they can meet one another, and once a month they could do presentations and get to know more about the university, at least from a faculty point of view. I thought I should do something like that for professors of the practice. There are 157 professors of the practice here at Boston College. So with Megan Sweeney, I put together a list of 20 people, and we invited them to join our group. Three of them are in this room right now. I can see them. All of them accepted the offer, and it is the most vivacious group that I have. Now, why am I telling you this? So last year, at this time, I hosted a panel called the Race Panel. You may remember last year, just before Christmas, we had a number of different incidents on campus in which the state of race on the campus was deeply problematic and hurtful. And so I contacted the provost, David Quigley, and said, you and I should do something, and we hosted a race panel. It was a panel that had the dean of the law school, it had Vince Rougeau, it had Martin Summers, it had Min Song on it. It had a very, Gustavo Morello, it had a very diverse panel, and we had 450 people come to it, many, many faculty. We had 250 people in the front room, and we had 200 in overflow rooms that were set up behind it. I asked the tenure-track faculty of the one seminar that I host, how many of them went to the race panel? None. I asked the professors of the practice how many went. All 20 went. Why? Why that difference? What are we doing with our tenure-track faculty now at our universities? Are we in any way encouraging them to enter into the university or to get tenure so that they can get that by their research and whatever else they have to do, but by their research? So when I'm thinking that this university was really fever pitch, a bit fever pitch, last January, whence so many faculty went to it, the one group that notably was absent was tenure track. Our future tenure faculty were not there, but our professors of the practice were. There's something about how the new faculty entering here and their idea of the university is, it is even more narrow, it is more insular, it is more individualistic than ever before.
Yeah, I can speak to that, because I've certainly noticed it in my 15 years or so here. And now this is my last semester for my retirement, but I think that you just identified the single biggest change. So I would say that the issue is often posed ethically as that research dominates over teaching and we ignore the undergraduates. But that's not how, that's true, but I don't think that's the true scandal. The true scandal is what kind of research, rather than research versus teaching. And the research is totally graduate school oriented now. Every time my department makes an appointment, it is someone who does very, very well in a particular kind of research that in our discipline now has priority over other kinds of research, and we wind up hiring very, very narrow specialists. And that was not true when I came here. In fact, that was the reason I came here, this department, I think because of the Jesuit heritage, always had a broad focus on everything. And the narrowization, if you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, this is yet another indication of, because we have no culture of ethics, we have no culture that talks about our flourishing. We have no communitarian spirit here. I mean, other than the president's Christmas party, I don't know of any time that I'm ever going to be in the same room with maybe 250 employees of this university, for instance. So this is the way we are hired, the vocations that we have aspired to, and the structures that guarantee them, are actually more and more insular than ever before. And what's funny about my book, I'm the only one who has said that all you people talking about sports, all you people talking about adjunct faculty, all you people talking about tuition, all you people talking about students behaving badly, these are all connected. But they don't see that, because the nature of the university is to be siloed. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
I just joined the BC faculty the last semester, and
welcome.
I am an adjunct part-time person, but I've worked at five other universities before, and I am very surprised that here we don't have, like you said, a venue where I can meet the other faculty members. The other two universities that I was at always had a faculty meeting every month, so that I could gather with the rest of the faculty, but here I haven't met anyone that is not in my department. And I'm very committed to my students, so I meet with my students one-on-one, like that's a requirement that I make of them, and I get to know them. But I know that from what they say, they are very intimidated to go to office hours because they feel that we don't want to see them. When in reality, we are very excited when students come to see us. But that comes from advising. Advising is a place where I think students should be more encouraged to go and see their faculty. And then where the university needs to make more, as you said, of an effort for all the different entities to come together once in a while, at least a couple of times a year, so we can really get to know each other. Because if we don't have a relationship with each other, we're never going to build community.
Right.
Within the university or within the classroom.
Are you a professor of the practice or adjunct?
I am a part-time faculty member, yes. Yeah, well, okay. I just teach the class.
Oh, okay, good, good. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, Dave.
I was going to say, I mean, what you say about the individualism and its effect on what happens is really, it fits very closely with some of the emphases that I've taken in the writing that I've done about ethics. I mean, you know from our conversations and reading some of the stuff I've written that I have this very deep commitment to the notion of the common good as a central moral standard for how life in society ought to be operating. And the notion of the common good in a lot of American academia is regarded as an illusion. There is no such thing. It's all about my individual good. And finding ways to put these things together, I mean, I think it's deeply embedded in American culture in some areas anyway. Now, maybe you say in certain areas of business and medicine and so forth, there are ways in which people are more collaborative. And I think that's probably true, but there's very little articulation of how that works as a sort of community-based way of thinking about ethical standards that are operative. Even in the medical sphere, a lot remains focused on individual giving their free consent to procedures and so forth, even though there may be a strong emphasis on collaboration in the profession. But I don't know how we get around that in our society. The university, in some ways, the way you describe it, it seems to me is a symptom of some of the cultural dynamics that are operative in the larger society when you say we're all bright.
Not only that, though, the university is the last stop before these people will go on to become leaders in our country, in whether it's in any different enterprise. And I think what's really important is, and I haven't said a word about it, about how class has really been the gulf, the economic inequality gulf, has actually been uplifted, if you will, by the university. The university has made the gulf even greater because it's made so unaffordable tuition that the better schools are only places that those who are already in the governing class can attend and not those others. So the university is very much a structure that enables the expansive gulf to develop. Now, I run the Presidential Scholars Program, and I'm in my sixth year with them, and I've decided that we had to articulate our goals, and one was care for the common good. This has become a very big thing because these students every year have, at the end of their sophomore year, they have a funding to do work in a foreign language culture, and then at the end of the junior year, they have funding to do an internship. And many of them were just looking, what's the best that I could get, like what you were describing. And I introduced to them that this was a sustainable program, and therefore we had limited funding, and that I needed them to be thinking of the program itself as needing to be sustainable. And they had to think of the common good. So we had a whole session on the common good about how. We're trying to put in another program, and the whole question about the common good is something that they can grapple with. But these are 70 students who are among the best at the university. They're the only ones who receive an academic merit scholarship, and I had to teach them the common good. They're at Boston College. They're freshmen through seniors, and I had to teach them the common good. These are our best students. So it gives you an idea. We're talking about a core, and whatever. I'm not going to get into the core discussion, but this question about the common good is one thing that really strikes me, that if we're not teaching the common good, then we're not dealing with the real threat to the university, because there is no common good. That's why all these departments don't know what's happening, because they're not partakers of the common good.
Well, we don't have the faculty senate even.
I think though, similarly, though, David, like your work at the Center for Human Rights or the Boisy Center or the Jesuit Institute, these are hopes that they help get faculty together. Like I have 5 seminars going and I now have 70 faculty who meet in one of the 5 seminars that we run. The Boisy Center has been a famous networker for faculty and graduate students and a think tank, if you will, for the university. I think the core going for interdisciplinarity is an enormous development for the good. But we need a language to go with it, and the language of the common good. And we also need a diagnosis that says the university is not doing well. That's what I'm saying. The university is not doing well. If Eric has to give a report of what he thinks he saw in the newspaper about how many sexual assaults that were on this campus, and no one in this room who's interested in universities, why would you, university ethics, why would you be here, knew about what he's talking about, it gives you an indication of how little we know what's happening at the place that we work at and teach. So there needs to be a diagnosis. There needs to be something to remove the blinders that we have, in which there's an elegance about the university. It's you know, we were in Managua in the beginning, and we heard this woman at this place called Jubilee House, and she's in Managua, Nicaragua's second poorest country in the Americas, second only to Haiti. And we asked her a question about climate change. And she said, you know, only in the United States do you have the luxury to debate whether there is climate change. She said, we've lost coffee. We lost our major export over the climate change of the past 7 years. We know what climate change is. You have the luxury of not doing that. You live in fantasy land. This phrase that she said has stuck in me since I came back here, limping all the way, and looking at this campus, and I kept saying to myself, we're in fantasy land. Like, what research are we validating? You know, it's fantasy research. Why is it that we don't know anything about our students other than what grade they got on their paper? There's something about a fantasy that's going on here, and how do we have a diagnostic to say we need to ask ourselves, do we understand the place that we're teaching at? Claire?
I wonder, Jim, I look forward to reading the book. I haven't yet. If you talk at all about the influence of money, that is the higher and higher tuition, the influence of paying that much money has on the ethics of those of us who work in the university. And by that I mean, over the 15 years I've been in the dean's office, I feel dirtier and dirtier. I feel...
That's consoling.
And so parents, because they're paying so much money, increasingly demand things based on the fact that education is a commodity. The grades that professors give are a commodity. I see professors also in some ways corrupted, not directly, because they're not directly getting money, but by the students' expectation that, hey, I paid $120,000 for this education, you know, I deserve an A. And I've had development try to influence decisions. And it's very upsetting to me personally in my job, but I'm just wondering generally in the university, as the price of the university has become so high, and many of our students come from families that can afford to pay that price in full, how that begins to corrupt some of what we're offering students. Not to idealize, I mean, we are in an industry, you know, they have a right to certain standards in what they are purchasing, but nonetheless, they're not purchasing an A from me if I'm a faculty member. They're not purchasing a yes on an exception to a policy if I'm a dean. Do you think about the 10th chapter?
So the book is designed to take you step by step. So the first chapter is my argument. And my argument is that all these different issues that are happening at campuses are about ethics, and nobody's identifying them as about ethics. And secondly, nobody's identifying that they're related to one another because they are about ethics. So that's my first chapter. Second chapter, I talk about books that show that the university is in difficulty. And I try to show that, as a matter of fact, there's a lot of literature, like academic, what I said in the beginning about academics and professors and the, you know, the lecturer's professor, or there's others who are talking about tuition or the failure of liberal arts, or like Casuto has this new book out about graduate schools right now that's very fine. So there's a bibliography emerging. And then I try to talk about other things, and I talk about the university. I first talk about cheating. I do a whole thing about the cheating scandal at Harvard just to use a case to say, let's look at this. So that as you're reading, and then I have a chapter just on what do I mean by ethics and ethics in the university. And then you get to the geography of the university. And then I have students behaving badly, race, gender, sports, and then a chapter called commodification. And the real issue are the parents. It's not the student. The student may come up to you really arrogantly and say, I don't understand why I got this grade, you know, and really say it in a very different way than previous students do, because there's a $45,000 bill that goes along with that. And then there's a lot in which their families have been saying, we're supporting that university by sending you there, which is a whole new framework of understanding education. But I want to give you two little things that have happened to me as the director of the Presidential Scholars of how I encounter commodification. And they're so hysterical that it gives you an idea of just how wild things are. One was my first year, I was hosting open house one parents' weekend. And these parents came up to me, and they knew who I was. And they said, what do you do? And I said, I teach. Where? I said, here. You teach here? So they thought I was like Father Joe, who had been recruited to be like this figurehead to run the program. Not that I had any, you know, background or any competency. And I said, I do. And they said, oh, you teach freshmen? I said, no, actually, I teach mostly graduate students and a couple of undergrads. You? You teach here? You teach students? Now, their son had won a merit scholarship. He was getting a $250,000 package to come here. He had already been here for a month. He came from a Jesuit education before coming here. They just talked to me in a way as if I was hired help.
Oh, welcome to my world.
Yes. At the end, they kept doing this. So they were really kind of rude. I just turned to them. I said, Google me. And I wrote it. The mother called a week later. The mother called and told our administrator to pull me out of a faculty conference. She needed to talk to me immediately. She had Gloria Rufo so beside herself that when I got out, I said, what is this about? I thought maybe her husband died, something had happened. He's not doing his laundry. I said, I want to make it clear. I will ruin your reputation. I will talk about you. I will trash you. I will tell this story with your name attached to it. I will make sure that your son's previous school knows it. You will never do this again to me. I hung up. The next time, last year, tomorrow, I have 54 high school seniors coming here. 54 high school seniors, I call them the Munchkins. They arrive, and we will do a series of interviews for 3 days to discern who should be the 15 or 16 who get a full ride here. Not housing, but tuition remission and a variety of perks for really one of the most successful academic merit scholarship programs in the country. And we do very, very high yield. This, we had one 2 years ago. She wrote a book, high school senior. She wrote a book, it was published. Grover Norquist wrote the foreword to it. It was on taxation. She hadn't paid any taxes, but she did a book on it. When we didn't accept her, her father called me up and started screaming to me on the phone, saying, did I realize that I had overlooked, and on what grounds had I done this? Now, this is an academic merit scholarship. And he's now screaming at me. And I said, you know, sir, he says, do you have anybody who did a book? Now, one of our students had just founded a corporation that was publicly listed as a high school junior. I thought that was impressive. I had another, she's a pilot of fighter jets. She was one of my candidates. So I had a really illustrious path. So I said, I'm not going to go down that alley. I feel that very confident that when we make out decisions, we make a good decision. And then he started yelling again. I said, sir, do you know the difference between entitlement and merit? And he said, no. I said, your call is about entitlement. My program is about merit. Thank you very much. I hung up. Entitlement. That's the other word for commodification. There's an arrogance out there. And the arrogance of the parents is really now frightening. And you see students, you know, talking on their phone to their, many of them, to their parents. It takes a village to, you know, it's actually, we got the village. We got the whole family with us, and an entire narrative. And none of this is being looked at as being connected to this question of ethics. None of this is, these are all different narratives that are insular. And so the bigger question, are we having a discourse about ethics, human flourishing, and the goals of the university, are they here? That's not here, because we don't have a, like you're saying, we don't have a format, we don't have a way of gathering. But we also have our responsibilities that prohibit us from getting together. There's no incentivization for doing this. Yeah.
Now that's the question I'd like to get your assessment on, because I've been in Boston College for 30 years, and I see a real difference in the nature of the institution between when I came here and now. And the reward system, it seems to me, for faculty now is almost entirely on research, and almost usually a very narrow definition of what research means, and a very narrow definition of factors that assess the faculty, or at least in the School of Management where I'm housed. And again, I don't know what the case is in other parts of the institution, but I'm assuming there's some similarities. And so it seems to me that if you want to tackle this ethics problem, you also have to tackle the incentives, and I would love to hear your take on
it. One of the things, though, that I found, like, forming this committee, professors of the practice. I originally thought that when we formed this committee, I would be listening to lots of horror stories, because when I was reading about the life of the adjunct of teaching at five different institutions and trying to get one course here and one there and not having an office, not having a mailbox, not having access to the Xerox machine, all sorts of these different things going on. At the same token, I thought I would be encountering that here. What I did hear was quite a number of faculty who made a decision. This was the only decision they could make, but many made a decision that they wanted to not be in that tenure cycle. They wanted to be more involved with the students. They wanted a different set of criteria to govern the way they were proceeding. And the more I listened to the professors of the practice, so I don't know people who are actual adjuncts now, so I'm really interested in your narrative. I'm finding that in a way, they are doing a foray into saying, well, this gives me some space. We had in my department, for instance, a discussion about faculty who wanted to go from a 3-3 to a 3-2, so that those who wanted to go to a 3-2 were doing more research. But that there were quite a number of faculty who felt fine staying with the 3-3, that they didn't want the added expectation on research because they wanted to do more of the teaching and more of the classing. I think these are all positive developments. I think there's a lot to be said more about professors of the practice, the 157 positions we have here. I don't know enough about the adjuncts who are here themselves, but I think we see them opting for a different structure. And that structure opening up a bit. And I think that's what a discourse would allow us to realize, that there are things happening that are good, but most of us don't know about it because we're on a trajectory that isn't there. So so I'm just suggesting that we can seek better models, and it may help us to ask these questions. I think Alan's question about what research are they doing is really significant, because it's not just that they are doing research, it's what is the research and for whose benefit. And whether it's connected to David's question about whether it's connected to the common good, that I'm interested in. Tom?
I'd love to hear your thoughts about where to go from here, how to develop a culture of ethics at the university. Because I would venture to say that everybody in this room, everybody at the university faces ethical quandaries, no matter what department it's in. But you're talking about it at a different level.
Yeah, I have so that's what my editor asked me to do. And I did this at a book signing party, which I'm going to spare you. But the last five pages of my book are if I were a university president, which I handed the book to Father Leahy. He's talked to me about quite a number of things, but not about the book. And my editor had suggested that I do that, but what I did is I actually looked at what a university president should do about bringing ethics into the university. And I talk about a committee, not unlike what Ruth Simmons set up to deal with the slavery question, which was a question about investigating the nature of the university and then putting a charter for trying to put it on the right course. So I thought it was a good model to work with. But I'm very, very, very specific there. So the first thing, what do I really think? Read my last six pages. I'm very candid about who and what should be involved in this charter. But then I say, I am not a university president. I am a faculty member. We know that on our campuses, not just at BC, but on most campuses, academic freedom only belongs to tenure-track faculty. Adjuncts certainly know that they don't have as much academic freedom that a tenure-track faculty or a tenured faculty has. And professors of the practice know that they don't have as much as that. But the fact that our faculty are not speaking is deeply, for me, problematic. They are the ones who have the freedom to speak. So they're the ones who should be here talking about this. You're all in very different disciplines, but how many are tenured faculty here at this, and how many of the tenured faculty bother to read this book? They're the bear. The administrators are too, but the bear is also that our colleagues are really not yet interested in this topic, even though, like your question, they're on a trajectory that is really alienating them from themselves even more so. And that if you do look that, you know, I work with this premise on what is ethics about. Wayne Meeks at Yale University says, making morals means making community. I find that a very significant insight, that human flourishment comes collectively and that ethics is constitutive of trying to create human flourishing. We have to somehow get our faculties, our tenured faculties, to appreciate what the adjuncts and what the professors of the practice already understand. They're the ones who went to the race panel, not all of the, none of the, very few of the tenure track, but some of the tenured faculty went. So it's how do we make inroads there? That's why I think it is up to the university president to do it. I don't think we'll see movement from the faculty. I just think that they're so cantankerous and they're so opted out. I mean, go to the offices. When are they there? You know, who can say that these are the 3 hours they're going to be disposable for others to see them? What company says? Now, that's not to say they're only doing 3 hours of work. They're doing all their other work at other times. But 3 or 4 hours or 5 hours of office hours, they can say anytime they want. They can say that they're doing it 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Monday through Friday, and they fulfilled it. And no student is going to come to their office, which is why they did that. Why they did? I'm an early riser. I fulfilled this thing. There is no culture that is there. Our faculty are a deep problem. Every university about this issue. They'll come. They'll attend rallies, but they won't do the hard work of this. Our adjunct faculty will because they understand that their rights are jeopardized. Our professors of the practice do because they're already involved in this process. But we need leadership. We need the leadership from presidents. We need presidents like Derek Bach or Ruth Simmons, who says, I was talking to one down at Loyola Baltimore, Brian Linnane. You know, I've given him a copy of the book, said, you know, you should come to my conference. We're having a nice conference on this. You're a great Jesuit university president. We should see what you have to say about leadership and university ethics. But we need our presidents to say, there is a problem on our campus. and it's really about not having a culture of ethics. That's really what I'm looking for. Yeah.
And what role do you think that students can play in influencing this change, if any?
Well, I think students are already playing the role. So when I said that the first in the Take Back the Night, that's a perfect example of how faculty and students work together to raise a consciousness issue. And if you look at, so the whole chapter on gender, if you look at it, you'll see all the different cases that were brought up about sexual assault were all brought up by women students who collectively worked together to file suits, raise Title IX arguments, and find out how to do it collectively. So you think of the Women's Learning Center here on this campus, or you think of the bystander movement here on this campus. These are instances where students have already initiated an attentiveness to ethics. But students also, like the people who helped me research it, telling me, read Jezebel, you've got to know what really happens on campus. That was a real help too. And students want those narratives to come out. They just don't know how to do that, but they need support by faculty who are going to stand by them and actually be their speaker. We had two of our students. One of them, Mary Rose Fissinger, she was graduated last year. She was an editor at The Heights, and she had found out about that women's study that had happened here at BC about how women, the longer they were at BC, the less confidence that they had in themselves and in their own intellectual capacities. And there was a committee that studied this for 2 years, and I was on it. And then there was a report, but the report was never made public. But Robin Fleming and I were on the committee, and we both have chairs and, you know, have academic freedom. So we were the only ones who gave interviews. The people who chaired the committee didn't feel comfortable talking about it. So I think it's important for students to try to find out. Whenever something is not coming out, they should find out why is it not coming out. And so the only way the story about BC and this issue happened was because of a editor at The Heights wanted to write about what happened there. And no faculty member said, well, one did, said to a few students, here's the report, I have a copy of it, you can look at it. I think their initiative needs to be continued, and they need to be supported. And they need to help us to be more transparent. I think that the social media skills that our students have are something that they need to keep putting to good use about bringing ethics to the university. Accountability, in other words, and transparency.
So I think we have time for one more question, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I'm just thinking of like an elephant in the room, possibly. Behind a lot of this is the culture or cult of prestige in universities and how that plays into the admissions game, and that feeds in a lot of the emphasis on research, which is a primary lever for prestige. How do you think prestige kind of gets in the way of perhaps universities stepping forward and saying, we have a problem, that's why here's it?
So, you know, one thing that I talk about in my ethics classes is class. At the university, we talk about race, we talk about gender, we talk about sexuality, but we don't talk about class. And yet that is the most compelling issue for many of our students who are working to get through at their education here. And they're not able to go to the balls and everything else that's going. So what you call prestige, I call class. And I think that is a real problem, that the universities all want to look Ivy. They all want to look top class. They all want the prestige that goes along with it. And there's something where none of us is stepping back saying, who's running this show? If we're so smart, why is this happening? And my argument is that the trajectory of the university today, like Alan's comment and your comment about what you see today, 15, 30 years later, it all shows us that unlike the corporate world, where people actually do say where they think their job is going, we don't. And until we realize that we're part of this universe, we'll be hungering for that prestige as the end too. And it may not have anything to do with the common good. And it may have nothing to do with why we were originally attracted to wanting to teach in the first place. So I'm interested in the soul of the university. I'm not interested in being a muckraker. I was a muckraker when I was younger. Now I'm interested in a university. I'm interested in a university that accomplishes what a university should be, that it has some endpoint, some fundamental values that exist on the campus, not that they promote as part of their strategy for attracting people onto their campus. So thank you.
Thank you all so much for coming. Please eat whatever's left. The list of our events, if you're interested for this semester, also on our website, but we're so glad you could come. Can I get you anything?
Nope, I just want to stand.